And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM. Despite some minor schedule changes in our program, we should have Phil Wileto available on the line with us coming in from the United States. Phil, can you hear me?
Yes, Brennan, this is fine.
Oh, great. Okay, I can hear you now, and I know our listeners can as well. Okay, well, I know you're going to be here in person today as well as on the show, but again, thank you for making yourself available, and thanks for taking the time to be with us here at McMaster Radio, broadcasting to Hamilton Community.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I know there's been a lot of activity and a lot of action recently, especially as regards your event. At first, there wasn't a lot of people who had heard about it. Word got around, and there's been positive and negative commentary about the event. And I've received letters of interest from around the country. People now in Toronto are hearing about the event who hadn't heard about it before. And it seems there's a demand to hear about these issues and talk about these kind of issues. But on the other hand, the McMaster groups that were putting on the event had received some rudeness, at the very least, you could call it. Also, they received information that people would be bussed in and so forth in an impromptu fashion, which necessitated, for one thing, the booking of a larger room. So I was just wondering if you wanted to comment on that and talk about your thoughts on the various issues surrounding your talk.
Well, it's been an interesting week. We started off expecting to have a talk in a room that holds, I understand, about 40 people. And now there's talk of hundreds of people coming, both to support or to oppose, or most of them hopefully just to listen and see for themselves what they think. Unfortunately, there is a minority of people in the Iranian diaspora in both the United States and Canada who are so hostile to the Iranian government that they would like to prevent any objective discussion about the internal situation in Iran. And because I have commented on that internal situation in a way that didn't please them, they chose to target the talk and spread really what is a slander and libel about myself and my position. The talk actually was not about the internal situation in Iran at all. I was asked to speak about media myths in relation to Iran in terms of its nuclear program, whether Iran is trying to develop a nuclear weapon, whether it represents a threat to world peace, whether it's an existential threat to Israel, and so on. I wasn't planning on really going into the internal situation in Iran except as it relates to attempts by the Western media to demonize and isolate the government and so the country as a whole. But I mean, I've been accused of being in the employ of the Iranian government, specifically receiving money from the Revolutionary Guards, which is a ridiculous charge. No one could ever even pretend to come up with a scintilla of evidence about that. And the fact of the matter is, if any individual or organization in the United States receives money from any foreign government to promote their views in the United States, they have to register as an agent of a foreign power. That's the law. And I'm certain, since my positions are opposed to that of the United States government, that if that were the situation, I'm sure the U.S. government would have its ways of finding that out, and that's of course never. That's not the case, and it's not the case for anybody in the campaign for sanctions against sanctions or military intervention in Iran. CASME, the organization I'm associated with. So, but these lies have been circulating on the internet now for over a week. And it's created a near hysteria where the last thing I heard was that people were organizing out of Toronto in conjunction with right-wing organizations to come, and the implication was that they would attempt to shut down the talk. So this is very unfortunate, and it's catapulted the talk out of the realm of a small faculty lounge into the arena of fighting for free speech, And it's gone far beyond, you know, any importance that I might have had in the equation. So the talk is now being rescheduled under the auspices of the Hamilton Coalition Against the War, and I believe a Muslim organization on McMaster campus. And I expect that there'll be a great deal more attention, and I'll have a chance to talk to a lot more people. So I should probably thank that small minority that has been whipping up an hysteria or trying to whip up an hysteria around this event and spreading just the most baseless lies about myself and my position.
Yes, you know, and this has caused a logistical situation now, too, because there had been interest in your book, but now we're going to have to be able to bring more copies of your book. And I understand you're running out of copies, but we're going to get more out there. Your organization has been distributing copies of your book in defense of Iran throughout the United States, but it hasn't received circulation, to my knowledge, in Canada, and the opportunity has come now. And I'm just wondering, we have really not talked enough about your book, and it's interested some people that have approached me, and I just wanted you to reiterate, what is the basic or main content of that book?
Well, in the summer of 2007, I organized a five-person peace delegation to go to Iran and travel around the country for 11 days and see for ourselves if the mythology that had been built up around Iran in the public mind in the United States, at least, was correct. The view at the time was Iran was a very foreboding, dangerous place. People probably hated all Americans. The worst nightmare you could imagine would be to be plopped down in the middle of a religious setting surrounded by thousands of religious Iranians who suddenly would become aware that you were an American. And we thought, well, we didn't believe that that was the case, and we had many Iranian-American friends who told us that, you know, you should just go and see for yourselves. You'll have a wonderful time. Iranian people are very friendly. They're very generous. They actually like Americans, and that'll dispel that myth. So, you know, we studied up on the history and the culture of the country, and then five of us went over. There were two U.S. Army veterans involved in the anti-war movement, a woman who's an environmentalist, and an old friend of mine who's was a labor activist. And we went as tourists, basically. We worked out an itinerary with an Iranian tour agency, and we visited Tehran, Shiraz, Yazd, Esfahan, Homs, a number of smaller towns. We traveled 1,350 miles by van, and we had great interactions with all kinds of people. We met with students and teachers and business people and workers and goat herders and government officials and religious leaders. And everywhere we went, we were treated with the utmost courtesy and friendliness and curiosity and welcome. And that was what we learned in Iran, that what we were told was not the reality. So when I came back, I teamed up with two Iranian-American friends of mine, Rostam Pourzal from the Campaign Against Sanctions and Military Intervention in Iran, a woman named Simone Romanian from Northern Virginia. And we did a tour where we would talk about the myths, the media myths surrounding Iran. And, of course, this was all before the presidential election. So in presenting, you know, I did a slideshow of the trip and presenting what we saw, and then listening to the questions that were being asked and the answers that Rostam and Samin were giving, and then doing my own study around these issues. It was a process of about 2 years of research and talking and investigations and discussions and the public meetings that resulted in the book, which is called In Defense of Iran, Notes from a U.S. Peace Delegation's Journey Through the Islamic Republic. And we sort of used the trip as the literary handle in order to be able to open up the questions of Iran's nuclear program, its foreign policy, its internal government structure, just a lot of basic facts about the country, and the hard questions. I mean, what is the situation? What is the status of women in Iran? What is the status of lesbians and gays? Did President Ahmadinejad threaten to destroy Israel? Did he deny the Holocaust? We take up all of these issues in the book, and try to put them in a historical context and a political context. And the book is not uncritical of the Iranian government, but because it recognizes that the Iranian government has made tremendous strides in alleviating the extreme poverty that afflicted the majority of people in Iran under the Shah, and that's not my evaluation, that's the World Bank and numerous bourgeois scholars who work for the highest levels of the establishment in the United States, including the State Department and the Library of Congress. Because I said those things in a more objective evaluation of the situation, the book has been criticized by some folks who either were sorry the Shah left because their personal positions allowed them to prosper during that regime, or they're associated with the MEK, the Mujahideen al-Khalq, or they are members of the middle class who are unsympathetic with the poor and resent the fact that the country's oil wealth is used in large measure for social programs that benefit primarily low-income people. So, I mean, that's a legitimate difference. We have in this country who belong to the Republican Party who don't really care about the poor, and the Democrats who pretend that they do, and they fight it out democratically, and people should have the right to do that. And just like many members of the Iranian government are stating now, abuses have taken place in Iran by the government since the last election. I believe the head of the judiciary has charged that at least three demonstrators were arrested and beaten to death while in custody. The Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, ordered the shutdown of a large detention center after there were charges of abuse. And President Ahmadinejad has said that there was excesses by the security forces. So, I mean, I'm certainly not going to take the position that what's going on in Iran today is all good on one side and all bad on the other. I think both sides are composed of many different factions with many different political points of view, many different disagreements among themselves. And the point that I've been trying to make since the election is that it's not the position of North American activists in the anti-war movement to try to intervene in any way in that situation. We can analyze it, we can discuss it, we can try to understand it. But rather than build a movement to either support the Green Movement or support any particular figure in the government, our job is very simple: to continue to demand there be no war, no sanctions, no internal interference in Iran. And that's the message of the book, that's the message I've been spreading, and that's the message I'll be bringing to Hamilton.
And I think you've been pretty clear about that. Again, it's generating a lot of interest. Now, I mean, we've talked about Iran and we've talked about your book, but one of the things we haven't talked a lot about is yourself. And I mean, I understand you're a very dedicated activist. You've gone to Iran, you've written a book, you've toured the United States in 2008 in many cities. You're coming up to Canada now, and you are involved in a great deal of activities. I know you're looking at, there was a state capital for Jobs, Peace, and Justice rally, and there's the Virginia People's Assembly. You have events planned in February. What is it that you're doing right now? I mean, in the United States, what events and activism are you currently organizing or involved in?
Well, I mean, this has been a long journey for me. I mean, I started out, becoming politically active as a teenager. It was a time, the civil rights struggle in the United States, the beginnings of the anti-war movement. I grew up in Boston. That was the center of political fervor. And I got active and went in my politics beyond just opposing this particular war or that particular injustice to understanding that the system itself needed a fundamental change. And I've never left that view. That's been the mission of my life, to try to make some contribution to helping working people particularly understand that that they have the power to change their own lives if they come together in collective action. And we can build a society that's based on meeting people's needs instead of creating super profits for a small, wealthy few. So, I mean, that's my view. And all my life I've been involved in some type of activity like that. 99% of it volunteer. Every once in a while, I'll get a little stipend from some nonprofit group, but I don't get money really for what I do. So I make a living. I'm a tradesman. I'm home improvement industry, and I don't generally take money for political work because that gets too sticky. Gives ammunition to people like the folks who attack my talk. So it's just cleaner to do it on a volunteer basis. Here in Virginia, I've been here 10 years, and I belong to a small community organization called the Defenders for Freedom, Justice, and Equality. Most of the members are African American, and we work on issues like jobs, housing, police, community relations, as well as our involvement in the anti-war movement. And we put out a newspaper, a quarterly newspaper called the Virginia Defender. People could Google that and find it online. 15,000 circulation. It's a statewide paper now. We have a half-hour weekly radio program that my wife, Anna Edwards, hosts on a community radio station. We were instrumental in building a statewide anti-war coalition called the Virginia Anti-War Network that lasted about 5 years. And then about a year and a half ago was rolled over into this newer coalition called the Virginia People's Assembly that involves labor, community, faith-based, prisoner advocacy groups, students, healthcare advocates, and anti-war activists to try to unite all the various progressive struggles in the state. It's an uphill battle. It's what I call swimming up the waterfall. But we think that by basing our politics on an understanding that working-class people have much more in common than we realize, and that we need to come together across race and gender lines. At the same time, we need to have a fundamental understanding that communities of color in the United States are faced with a special oppression of racism and national oppression, and they have the right to determine the future of their own communities. So that the combination of a working class approach and respect for the right of self-determination of oppressed communities is what guides us in our political work, both domestically in terms of our work in the black community and the Latino community, particularly the immigrant community, but also our anti-war work, so that it's not necessary for activists in the Western countries that are the source of aggression and exploitation in the world to agree with everything that the government of a targeted country does in order to be committed to defend them as best they can from attack or threat of attack or sanctions or internal interference. Respect for the right to self-determination is the basic principle. If Mr. Mousavi, Mir Hossein Mousavi, had been elected president, we wouldn't change our policy towards Iran. It would be no war, no sanctions, no internal interference. If someone whose policies we disagree with far more than the present government came to power, it wouldn't change that view. It's not up to us to pass judgment on how another country develops if that country is under attack by the countries that have the greatest powers in the world, and of course the source of the greatest military, economic, political power is the United States, and it's wreaking havoc. And as an anti-war activist, that's my job to try to do something about it, and that's what we're trying to do here in Virginia. And I wrote an article about Iran that got on the internet, and you folks in your radio program heard about it, interviewed me, and then we discussed my coming up. And I'm always looking for a venue to try to get out the information that we have and the analysis that we have, and that's led us to the present situation where we might actually get a very nice turnout.
Oh, of course. And, you know, it's good to see that there's so much energy in the grassroots movement in the United States at every state. You know, you're talking about Virginia, and you, if you read Counterpunch, you learn about other movements in other states. There's activism on every level. And I think, you know, when you talk about fundamental change in society, if you did an opinion poll of Americans today, of United States citizens, I'm sure a vast majority of them would be talking about the need for systemic change. There's so much dissatisfaction and distrust with what's been happening at every level. level of government. People are increasingly coming to the belief, according to polls, that the government is not responsive to their interests, that it's very responsive to corporate interests. You know, it's very responsive to very wealthy special interests, and it's not responsive to Main Street USA. So I think it's really great that you're doing work to combine the struggles, because the struggle against war in Iraq, the struggle against the war in Afghanistan, the struggle against the escalation in Palestine and also in Pakistan are all connected to, you know, the desire for profit, the way that the United States government is really held captive in a sense. If you watch anything from Michael Moore to other documentaries, you know, people understand what we're talking about. So it's good that you've been able to combine or work to combine activism at that level. I think that's an interesting thing you sometimes see in Canada, and it's something to watch for Virginia. Now, I know Peter and Kevin are on their way to talk about Haiti, so I won't be able to go on much longer. But before we go, is there anything else you wanted to tell for our listeners?
Well, just that in terms of what you've just been explaining, it is true that people in the United States are very anxious. They're very nervous. The economic situation is very bad for working people. And straight on up the employment ladder, I mean, there are people with PhDs and well-paying white-collar jobs who are losing them in this economy. The problem is that there's also a great deal of confusion about why the economy is so bad and why things are so anxious, just feels personally threatening to people. And the media plays a tremendous role. I travel a lot for my job, and I always listen to the local radio stations. And it's just amazing how many right-wing talk shows there are, spreading the most unbelievable, bald-faced lies, but appealing to people's basest fears to create the view that the government is actually taken over by some left-wing movement, and Barack Obama is a socialist, and we've got to take our country back and all of this foolishness, when, you know, it was the Republicans that ran the economy into the ground, and Barack Obama saved capitalism, and he saved the banks. He didn't save the working class, but the problem is the bankers and the industrialists and the stockbrokers and all of those that run the economy like a little fiefdom. So the media is... I mean, we don't have a police state in the United States except in the communities of color. I think in the black community in particular, in the Latino community, we approach that pretty closely. But for the country as a whole, it's the media that keeps people controlled. And that's why addressing these media myths, whether it's about the economy in the U.S. or about the existence or non-existence of racism or about U.S. foreign policy and how... a country like Iran is targeted for isolation and demonization and sanctions and possibly a military attack. Why it's necessary to take every opportunity, whether it's this radio station or a talk in a faculty lounge in Hamilton or a book or a speaking tour or any other means of communication that we can utilize to try to get another point of view out. And I'm disappointed. Not surprised, but it's the fact that a small but vocal minority of right-wing fanatics was able to affect the possibility of a talk in Hamilton is a bad sign. And I hope that even those who may not feel that they're going to agree with me would come out to the talk when it's rescheduled in Hamilton, and I understand possibly in Toronto, and keep an open mind and listen to what I have to say. If you disagree with it, we're going to have a long question and answer period, and we can have a dialogue. But we have to be able to fight through the power of the right-wing media and that small minority that would prevent an alternative voice from being heard.
Okay. Well, I think you've been very detailed in your response. I thank you very much. You know, we're going to be talking about your expanded event and giving details as they come. And, of course, we'll be talking about your book as well and getting the information out to everyone. So, everyone, you can listen in week after week. Here are the updates on the event booking and what's being planned. Phil, we're going to keep speaking with you. We're going to keep updated and keep you updated and be working together. So, Phil, again, I'd like to thank you very much for coming on our program today.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Brennan, so much for having me. Say hello to Peter and Jessica and everyone, and we'll be looking forward to seeing you in person soon.
Thanks very much, Phil.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
And that is Phil Wileto, activist from the United States, author of the book In Defense of Iran, and member of the Campaign Against Sanctions and Military Intervention in Iran.